I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. We resume our conversation with Victor Lukerson, author, Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street.
What do you want readers to understand about what happened in Greenwood after the massacre and what systematic roadblocks were placed in front of its citizens?
Yeah, there really is so much to unpack in Greenwood after the race massacre. My book is split into three parts. The first part deals with early Greenwood and the massacre itself. And part two really does just try to unpack what was Greenwood after this event over the next 50 years or so. And so, I mean, the first thing people really need to understand is that Greenwood rebuilt, and they rebuilt fast. They did not get much outside help from White Tulsa. In fact, White Tulsa was trying to undermine their rebuild. But, you know, they found a way to, whether it was like living in tents for a while initially, getting help from outside groups like Black social organizations or the NAACP, relying on churches in the community to help raise funds. You know, they were able to rebuild this community such that by the next year, more than 1,200 buildings were destroyed during the race massacre. And by the next year, 1,000 structures had gone back up. And so it was a very quick rebuild, which, you know, that is, honestly, it's amazing that they were able to do that as a mode of survival. But that rebuild and the way they were sort of forced to do it by themselves ended up having a lot of negative knock-on effects for the community. So when you sort of fast forward on the timeline in Greenwood a little bit, so let's say first in the 1930s, that was actually when, during the Great Depression, the Homeowners Loan Corporation began grading communities all across the United States, giving them letter grades from A through D, A being the best community, D being the worst community, according to these sort of economic models they had. And Black communities systematically were given D ratings. And on these maps that they would draw, they would color the D neighborhoods red. That's where we get the term redlining from. And so Greenwood was a redline neighborhood in the 1930s. Even though you had wealthy families like the Goodwins living there, doctors, attorneys, all these folks who made this community tick, they were all living there in the same neighborhood, but it didn't matter sort of what your station was in this world of Greenwood. To the outside world, you live in the redline neighborhood, which meant you were gonna have fewer loan opportunities, and overall just a worse economic outlook based on this evaluation. And so that was one issue that really affected the neighborhood very negatively. And then you fast forward a little bit further even to the urban renewal era. Again, you have all this dilapidated housing that existed in the 1920s. Some of it was still there 50 years later. And so now it's so easy to cast Greenwood as blighted, as a neighborhood that needs to be quote unquote renewed. And actually we ended up with the entire neighborhood being bulldozed in the late 60s and early 70s. The claim was that the neighborhood was blighted, but the issues that it had traced their way all the way back to the 1921 race massacre.
I want to talk a bit about, in some of my research on the devastation in Greenwood, I found that there was certainly a complicit, coordinated plan, because I read somewhere where they used what they call a biplane to drop dynamite on the Greenwood community to help to devastate that particular community. In the book, The Burning, chronicle how whites looted Black homes of very fine items. And after the aftermath, and I believe I read in the press information, photographs of the devastation was prohibited by the police. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Afterward, the police were confiscating images of the attack. Luckily, they didn't get all of them. We have a fair amount of photographic evidence, but that was their plan as a sort of they actually called the Black press propagandists. That's what the police said in Tulsa. And then so that's why they were trying to claim their images.
And I want to talk about, you mentioned, or it's mentioned, that the Red Cross came in as an organization understanding what had just occurred in the Black community. Speak a bit about that.
Sure. So after the race massacre, as I've said, White Tulsa really was not doing very much to help Greenwood. There were sort of two different groups of white elites. There was sort of a kind of well-meaning group who said they wanted to help, but they were so proud that they proclaimed that we don't need outside help. You know, white Tulsa's got this. We'll fix Greenwood. And they actually turned away donations from outside groups. So then this one group gets ends up turning being ousted by another more craven group who actually really all they want to do is raise the neighborhood further and take it over to build a train station or industrial site. So that's sort of what White Tulsa was up to. And this is all happening in the days and weeks after the race massacre in 1921. However, the Red Cross, the outside group, came in, and you know their whole mission is to help with often natural disasters, but sometimes human-made disasters, as this was. And so a man named Maurice Willows, who was a regional director for the Red Cross, came to Tulsa the week of the race massacre, and he stayed there for through the rest of the year, actually. So on sort of the most basic level, the Red Cross was providing aid to massacre victims. You know, they helped erect tents in the community, distribute meals, provide materials so that people could build clothes and all that, those kind of things that we kind of expect of the Red Cross. But also, Maurice Willows had a major role to play in sort of navigating these politics with White Tulsa. One very surprising fact that I found in my research was that at a city council meeting in June 21, just a few weeks after the race massacre, the mayor of Tulsa was trying to get funding to expand the police force. He actually wanted to buy a fleet of machine guns. So Maurice Willows was a regional Red Cross director, and he was one of the few white people who was really looking out for Greenwood's interests. On the humanitarian side, Maurice Willows and the Red Cross, they helped distribute meals to Greenwood residents. They helped them acquire and construct tents in the burned out neighborhood. And then also even provided materials to create new clothes for people who lost everything. But Maurice Willows also had a major role to play on the political side of things. He was able to sort of negotiate with the mayor of Tulsa and other city leaders to make sure that the money was being funneled towards the proper places. One of the most surprising things I found in my research was that just weeks after the race massacre, the mayor of Tulsa was advocating using funds to buy a new fleet of machine guns for the police force. Again, with this sort of imagined idea that there was going to be a black uprising or black retaliation of some sort. But Willows was able to sort of convince the city instead to use that money for Greenwood relief. And so he really had an important role to play in the community, both on the humanitarian side of things, as well as on the political side.
And I know you're not a psychologist, but I'd like for you to take a stab at this particular question. Do you think the community of Greenwood at that point in time, in 1931, experienced trauma? And do you think some of that, the residual trauma, exists to some extent today?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Actually, I have a chapter in my book shortly after the race massacre that's called The Myth of an Impervious People. It was really important for me to sort of deconstruct what I call the resilience narrative about Black people, that, you know, we can sort of take anything and no matter what white America throws at us, we're going to overcome it and sort of come out unscathed. I feel that sort of reinforced quite often in narratives that are passed down about slavery and the civil rights movement, for example. But, you know, we're human like anybody else and we suffer. And so I really wanted to capture that in my book. And so I actually spent a lot of time researching what happened to some of the individual entrepreneurs of the early Greenwood era. In particular, Lula Williams was somebody that I learned a lot about. So as I said earlier, she was this amazing movie theater owner, sort of entertainment mogul, one of the most high-achieving Black women in America in the 1910s. Her Dreamland Theater was destroyed. Her confectionery was destroyed. Her family's apartment was destroyed. The family files a lawsuit seeking to get insurance claim. It's denied. The city denies helping. So they were able to rebuild their theater, but they didn't. I mean, they had to overextend themselves to do it. You know, they're selling off the other theaters outside of Tulsa to try to raise the money. They ended up having to sort of get some predatory loans, try to keep everything afloat. And as all that was going on, Lula herself was suffering from this mental decline. You know, she was having harder time walking up the stairs, harder time remembering her numbers to, you know, do her finances. Ultimately, she actually was committed to a sanitarium in about 1924 and died in 1927. And the Black press in Tulsa actually attributed her death to the race massacre. And so that was a very specific example of somebody suffering from, you know, you mentioned, I'm not a psychologist, but she was suffering from some level of trauma. And all of her issues began in September 21, just a few months after the massacre. And so I think we see plainly there that, you know, there were devastating psychological issues from this event. And I think today you still see it. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm from Montgomery, Alabama, which has its own sort of traumatic racial history, both in the Civil War and in the Civil Rights era. But I feel like that history of Montgomery is so public. It's kind of America's history. And so it's not as much of a burden to be from Montgomery and process that. Whereas in Tulsa, this issue has been hidden. It's been obfuscated. People have been threatened for trying to talk about it for so long. That thing is a much more personal history and intimate history. And being forced to internalize that for so long, and maybe even being told that what you're saying isn't true or doesn't matter, I think that does have negative psychological ramifications. And so I think hopefully as we can create more works that bring to light all that happened in Greenwood, I think that is part of the healing process. There's lots of other things that need to happen involving reparations and the city of Tulsa doing right by what occurred here. But I do think that discussion element and making everything more public is a big part of what the community needs to take steps forward.
It's a little bit akin to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Before you heal, there has to be some degree of contrition or some admittance that some wrong was done. And you can get toward reconciliation once you can have groups to at least agree that some harm has been done to aggrieved groups. So I think there is, before you can get to forgiveness, you need to have individuals or groups agree that something happened and speak about it truthfully. There's so much in your book about how Black America used the press to find justice and reveal the truth of their experiences. The Eagle in Tulsa was owned by the Goodwin family, which you have referenced earlier, for generations, and is as much a character in the book as the Goodwins themselves, throwing his weight behind local and national political fights and serving as the organ of the community that it covered, intertwined with Greenwood's faith in a way very few newspapers are. How do you feel about the state of the Black media today and the media in general?
You know, it's really interesting for me as a journalist. I'm a professional journalist, have been for about a decade now, but I definitely came up in a very, traditional training regimen. You know, I went to a predominantly white school, University of Alabama. I worked for predominantly white news outlets, Time Magazine, where I initially started my career. And so sort of objectivity is the holy grail if you come up that route. You know what I mean? Like the entire goal is to sort of say, what can I do to remove myself from this situation completely if I can? And then write about it in a completely dispassionate way. And that's really kind of like how you're sort of taught to approach a lot of journalism in that mindset. And so when I came here to Tulsa and started researching the Black press historically, but also observing the Black press today, both the Eagle and a news outlet called the Black Wall Street Times here, I sort of realized there was a whole different approach you could have to covering a community. You know, you can sort of be invested in the outcome in a way that is sort of frowned upon, I think, in the traditional press sometimes. And, you know, we see in historically that was vital for Greenwood. You know, there's a chapter in my book about the Eagle in the 40s and how during World War II, factory jobs, you know, exploded across the United States, and they did in Tulsa as well. There was a factory building airplane bombers for the war, but they excluded Black workers from this place. And so the Eagle was very actively, you know, calling for those jobs to be given to Black workers in editorials, sort of exposing the injustice and investigations. And even Ed Goodwin, the publisher, he would go and meet and negotiate with the people who owned the bomber plant. And so that was taking a lot of steps beyond just, I'm going to write an article and call it a day. You know what I mean? And so I think that spirit is still here in Tulsa today. You know, we saw the Black Wall Street Times was very active in organizing the protests after the murder of George Floyd here in Tulsa. And all this is depicted in my book. And so I think that that role is really vital for Black communities. There's a quote I really loved finding in my research from a Black reporter named Charles Loeb. He worked for the Black newspaper in Cleveland in the mid-century. And he was doing an interview about objectivity for, I think, Columbia University did a lot of oral history projects interviewing Black publishers. And so Charles Loeb, he's getting asked, can you be objective? Is it important to be objective? And Charles Loeb said, well, it's kind of hard to be objective when your foot's on my neck. You know, and I just thought that really captured so well sort of what the Black experience is and how this sort of holy grail objectivity doesn't quite hold up to scrutiny when the world itself is not objective. You know what I mean? And so all that to say that, you know, historically it's been vital. It remains vital today. I think we're seeing, especially like post George Floyd murder, we've seen a lot of new efforts to create a more solid Black infrastructure. And I think we've seen some new outlets starting and new Black outlets partnering together in a more dynamic way. So I think there's some positive opportunities in the Black press, but you know, overall, it is a challenging media environment today. So I think to succeed, it really requires like engaging with the community and helping them understand that you represent them, as opposed to, you know, representing advertisers, for example, or business interests. You have to sort of prove to people you represent their interests in order to get them, I think, to engage with you.
I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to Like It Is. My guest is Victor Lucasen, author, Built From the Fire: The Epic Story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street.
You write about the Goodwins' Willow Lake Farm being a symbol of Black success, but in many ways, it was a sign of things to come in Black America. With that success becoming decoupled from the daily rhythms of life in the heart of the Black community, end quote. Can you talk more about this?
Sure. So, as I said, part two of my book is sort of about what happened in Greenwood after the race massacre. And in some ways, that part of the book becomes this sort of like slow burn, slow unraveling of the community. I mean, it's really slow. It takes like 25 years to play out. But we sort of see a lot of folks in the Black middle class and upper class who are really striving for desegregation. That's kind of like the holy grail of the goal, right? I mean, it makes sense because, well, we can sort of integrate these communities. Black people are going to have access to better jobs, better schools, more resources. It seems like it's going to be a really great thing. And you sort of see that if you follow, you know, the NAACP's arc in that era and Black outlets like the Oklahoma Eagle and others who are really sort of advocating for helping Black people enter white spaces. But I guess as I sort of watched it all unfold historically, you sort of get to observe the fact that this sort of dream of an integrated society never really played out, and that was not the fault of, you know, NAACP or the Eagle or those groups. It was because when the Black people showed up, the white folks would leave en masse, you know, sometimes, you know, bombing houses and bombing people on the way out. And so it was kind of sad for me to sort of watch it. Like, I knew obviously what was going to happen because, you know, I live in America now and I know what things are like, but the folks in 1940 or 50 didn't know that. And so I really wanted to capture in my story sort of the worldview they had about the opportunity that could be had with integration or even with leaving Greenwood. And then how, you know, because of the overarching American society and white flight issues such as that dream was never realized. And so it was really important, I think, to just sort of highlight that and sort of walk through the logic of it so that people can kind of see that actually was a noble goal to have this integrated society, but some people in our society were sort of not willing to hold up their end of the bargain.
Do you think there was a degree of envy among white Tulsans to the success of Black Tulsans there? You think envy, jealousy played a part in storming the Greenwood community?
I think that could have been some of it. I know that's a really popular sort of theory or perspective. I don't think that was a huge driver, but I do think that maybe instead of like envy, exactly what I've seen or noticed, it seems more like, well, I guess the envy part of it, to me, the envy angle seems like that's like the higher class people interacting. But I think on sort of a lower level, we know that lower class level, economic level, we know that Tulsa was in an economic slump in early 1921. And a lot of like working class white people were losing their jobs. And sometimes black people were being kept on those jobs because they made lower wages. And so I think on that level, there was some level of sort of maybe envy is the right word for it. But a little I think resentment is a better word. I think there's more resentment going on in Tulsa in 1921. And sort of beyond the financial aspect, we also saw in that era before the race massacre that black people were becoming more and more likely to sort of not get up on the trolleys in Tulsa for a white person. Black people were approaching police who were trying to make an arrest in Greenwood and telling them not to, or even threatening them. And so there was just a lot of black sort of autonomy going on. You know, black people were sort of standing up for themselves in all of these different ways. And so I think that was bringing a little bit of resentment about what they were doing. And honestly, probably a little bit of fear, to be honest with you. You know, there's always been sort of a latent fear of a black uprising. You know, I think if you look at the slavery era, 1921, 2020, summer protests, there's just latent fear of a black uprising that kind of percolates American society. And so I think that resentment and that fear are two of the sort of emotions I see more than envy when I think about what caused the race massacre.
Were there other Black Wall Streets around the U.S.?
Yeah, there definitely were. That was another one of those things that I didn't know that much about before I started my research, but I thought was really important to highlight in my book. You know, and around the South, actually, I sort of came to understand that, you know, we have this sort of knowledge about the Great Migration and people like, you know, desperately leaving the South to go to Chicago, New York, Detroit, places like that. But it's also true that in the South, sometimes people would leave their rural stations and come to the bigger community, whether that was Greenwood or in Virginia. Richmond, Virginia was a really prominent Black community in the early 20th century. Maggie Walker became the first Black woman to own a bank in that community. And in Durham, North Carolina, the North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company became one of the most prominent Black businesses in the country. Again, this is all happening right around the time of the race massacre in early 1920s. And so, yeah, I think throughout the Deep South, you would find other communities that had prominent Black business districts and other communities that had their own Greenwood Avenue, you know, a street lined with hotels, shops, theaters, a place for people to enjoy themselves and have the dollar circulate. So I think that was actually a really kind of a common model actually of the era. And, you know, when I mentioned earlier that Du Bois was traveling around the country in the early 1920s, he commented on that himself. He commented on the fact that he was finding these places where Black people were not really concerned with what was going on with white Tulsa or with white America. You know, they're creating their own opportunity and their own success. And he found that to be very admirable.
In your view, what can Americans take from Greenwood's century-long struggle for equality?
I mean, I think there's a few things to take from it. I think for me, again, as somebody who sort of grown up in the internet age and sort of an age of collapsing institutions, I feel like every institution that has sort of been around when I was a kid is like on its last legs in some sense, whether that's like the presidency, the church, newspapers, a lot of things that were seen very stable when I was a kid in the 90s are no longer so. But I think when you learn about Greenwood, you really see like, oh, wow, these institutions are extremely vital. Like the church, as an example, was extremely vital in, you know, helping sort of stabilize people spiritually, but also like helping provide them resources after the race massacre to build up their community. The newspaper was extremely vital in not only informing people about sort of the injustices of the day, but also like letting them know what their friends were doing at the sorority function or, you know, whose kid's birthday it was. All those like small things that really make a community whole. The Eagle is really valuable in providing that. I think when I've sort of, I think hoping people read this book, they sort of recognize the fact that being involved in your local community, however you want to do that, is extremely important. You know, we live in a very atomized society now. We're sort of all on our phones. We're all obsessed with national politics. But, you know, change happens on the local level. And so, you know, the modern part of my book walks through a lot of what's going on with local activists in Tulsa right now, and sort of walks through all the efforts they've made to advocate for themselves, just as people were doing decades and eras ago. And so I really hope that when people read the book, it makes them sort of want to sort of reengage with their own local communities in the same way that Greenwood books have been doing for the last 100 years.
Talk briefly about reparations. I know that there was a state legislature later I think was successful getting some degree of reparations, or is proposing to have reparations for some of the survivors of the massacre. Can you speak a bit on that?
Sure. So there's been, you know, the effort to get restitution for the race massacre in Greenwood really began the day afterwards. To go back to Lula Williams, the day after the race massacre, she went to speak to her attorney about how she was going to get some money for what she had lost. Her family still has not. Sort of in modern times, there's been a reparations movement in Tulsa that really began in the late 1990s. A former state legislator for Greenwood, Don Ross, was able to build some level of momentum in the Oklahoma State Legislature for reparations. There was a, at the time, called Tulsa Race Riot Commission that was enacted. And so they sort of released a report that sort of laid out factually what happened. And this commission provided recommendations for reparations, but the Oklahoma State Legislature never followed up on them. There was an effort also to file a lawsuit seeking reparations from the city of Tulsa, but it was claimed that the statute of limitations had expired because people like Lula had actually filed lawsuits in 1921. Fast forwarding 80 or 90 years, the government says, well, you already tried and didn't work, which and I think is, you know, sort of a ironic injustice, because you can't pretend as if the treatment Lula got in 21 was in any way fair. You know what I mean? But, you know, the effort continues. There's actually right now there's a lawsuit going on seeking restitution for the three living race massacre survivors. Actually, there was a hearing about it just this week. And so we're sort of trying to wait right now to find out whether this new case will end up going to trial. Will it be dismissed by the judge? No one quite knows yet how it's going to play out. But, you know, I think whatever happens with this case, there's going to continue to be restitution efforts and reparation efforts in Tulsa, because there's just too much factual evidence about what happened. And there's too many people who are descendants of the horrific event for this issue to go away until one of these sort of powerful entities does something about it.
Victor Lukerson, author, Built from the Fire, The Epic Story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. Thank you, Victor, for your time and your candidness and your great work. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Franklin.
Absolutely. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.